Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business. From liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
What could you do if your data was working for you and not against you? With Bloomberg delivering enterprise data directly to your systems, you get easy access to the details you want, optimized for higher level analysis, and financial data experts committed to helping you maximize your every move. Our data is made for more, so you can show the world what you're made of. Visit Bloomberg.com/enterprise data to learn more.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine. Plus, global business, finance, and tech news. The Bloomberg Business Week podcast with Carol Messer and Tim Stenebeck from Bloomberg Radio.
I have to say, on our planning call, when I heard that Brad Stone was going to join us on Amazon, I was like, okay, that's all I need. So let's get to it. Brad, as you know, he is Bloomberg News Senior Executive Editor of Global Technologies, the author of two books on Amazon, Jeff Bezos and the Innovation of a Global Empire, and of course, the Everything Store. Brad is there on Zoom in San Francisco. Brad, thank you so much. A lot going on, and I know you and your team have been busy this week. Amazon, where should we start? What do you think is the most important in this release so far?
Yeah, I think the question that was lingering over the company was whether it had slimmed itself down enough to boost profits, whether with all the layoffs, nearly 3,000 this year alone, it has made any progress in its effort to cut costs and match this new era of slowing post-pandemic growth. And Carol, you can see from a 12% after market boost right now, investors are happy with what they're seeing on operating income, net income, and the durability of AWS.
Do you see the good results today feeding through for Amazon through the end of the year, particularly as you mentioned on the piece about cutting costs through cutting back on the workforce? How does Amazon sustain that growth this year?
Yeah, I mean, we don't know. I mean, Amazon's performance is so tethered to the macroeconomic climate, and obviously with the growth report today, I mean, there are big questions about the health of the economy. I think, you know, what we're seeing with Jassy's comment about machine learning making the ad business better, and how the AWS business, they're really pitching it as a way to do AI cheaper, more efficiently. You know, they're trying to set this company up, not just for the next year, but for kind of this next era in Silicon Valley and say, like, this is the smart play. Whatever happens to the economy, this is the long-term smart play on AI.
I mean, and the thing that we're highlighting on the Bloomberg, Brad, you know, they're talking about that second quarter net sales, 127 to 133 billion. The estimate out there is 130. I mean, it's a sizable, you know, range there, but it's upbeat. And so you do wonder about what they are seeing about the outlook that gives them at least comfort in putting this out here. Or how do you see it when they put out a forecast like that?
I mean, they always leave their forecast large enough to drive an Amazon delivery truck through, you know, so I don't ever put that much stock in it. But look, I mean, this is like a beat across the board.
Yeah.
Even physical store sales were a beat. Online store sales are a beat. You know, so I think that, you know, they're seeing not just a kind of recovery in the top line, but all the things they've been working on for so many years, shorter delivery times, more fulfillment centers closer to customers, that these things are finally beginning to make a difference for customers and are a little bit more of a differentiator for Amazon, fast oncoming competitors like Walmart.com, et cetera.
Talk to me about the AI piece. We have in here I see six on the word count for AI here. Does that feel like enough to you? Does it feel like they're leaning into AI in this earnings report?
I mean, every company is right now, and I expect that on the media call at the bottom of the hour and the analyst call at the top of the hour, it's going to be, you know, AI like all these calls this week. But, I mean, the one explicit thing that they don't have is a consumer-facing, you know, large language model, chatbot to help customers. You know, Alexa was a version of that, but it's a little generation old. And so they're pitching these services to developers, like one is called Bedrock, where, you know, you can come and like tailor your own. So they're really seeing it as a part right now, at least of AWS and making their business and their AWS customers' business more efficient. You know, we'll see how much of that is like AI washing and how much is a real difference for competitors, for their customers.
I am blown away by the numbers. And I'm going to go back to physical stores. I mean, I guess, you know, because we all think about Amazon, we just order and it just shows up, you know, miraculously on our doorstep. Almost $5 billion in sales. I mean, is this something that they continue to invest in and build out, or is it just, again, very cautiously? But that's some real money.
I mean, if anything, Carol, it's the reverse. I mean, they've closed all the physical stores. So the number you're seeing here is Whole Foods, I mean, by and large. So, okay. You know, they've been cutting that business a little bit. They've closed some stores. I think that number shows like maybe some stability. Like they've closed the bookstores, they've closed the 4-star stores. Amazon Go has been whittled down to like a shadow of its former self. So, you know, they're done cutting, and perhaps that's reflective of maybe an overall sort of revival in just the supermarket category.
Is there anything else that you think Amazon needs to do this year to control costs, or does this earnings outlook read to you as a company that can happily continue to pour money back into itself?
I mean, we're right in the middle of the layoffs. I think this week was when they started the AWS layoffs, and the head of AWS described it as one of the worst days for the company. So I think they probably announced most of the cost cutting they're going to do. It's ongoing. It'll take place throughout the quarter. And at this point, you know, and also yesterday, by the way, they canceled another product, the Halo wristband, so one of their health initiatives. So I think at this point, most of the blood's probably on the floor, and you're right that from here on out, it's going to be a more careful and curated set of bets.
You know, Ed Ludlow pointing out, and this caught me too when I was reading through the press release, in terms of advertising, their advertising services business sales coming in at 23% year over year, a 35.5% outperformance relative to consensus. You know, we keep worried about anything ad related, ad connected. What is it that they are doing just so right? Or is it just because they are so huge, they're such a big part of everybody's world, and they reach so many individuals, if you will, that makes sense that they're really outperforming there?
Well, what they have said and what they want us to believe is that their investments in machine learning help match up ads with customers when they're searching in the Amazon search box. You know, my view as an Amazon customer is that they're simply just flooding the zone. I just think that they have thrown open the search results to paid results, to the highest bidder. And maybe there's a little machine learning there, but it's the increasing willingness in the post Jeff Bezos era to really sell search to the highest bidder that has that is the mainly powering that line.
Brad, fast forward for me to
which is a bummer for us then.
Yes.
But anyway, but good for them. Sorry, Maddie.
No. It's an excellent point. Brad, fast forward for me to the end of this earnings season here. When we look at these Amazon earnings, is this going to be the quote unquote bellwether for big tech fueling continued gains in the S&P, as we wrap up this earnings season?
I think it's consistent, Maddie, with what we've seen from Meta, with what we've seen from Alphabet. I haven't been paying attention. I'm curious about Snap earnings today. But, you know, that we've been through a brutal period of, you know, regression in big tech stocks and a lot of cost cutting, high unemployment now in Silicon Valley, or at least increasing unemployment, and, you know, a readjustment. And maybe this quarter is going to mark kind of the turning point here where, as I said, you know, most of the pain has been endured, and these companies now with their big bets on AI are beginning to rekindle some of their momentum.
Brad, you mentioned Snap, down 22% in the aftermarket, reported its first ever decline in quarterly revenue after making some major changes to its advertising tools. So first quarter revenue fell 7% to $988.6 million. So it missed the average analyst estimate of about $1 billion. So yeah, not good at all. Very different.
Perhaps not consistent with the overall theme then.
Well, it makes me wonder what Snap and Pinterest are doing differently, because they did not perform well, but Amazon, Microsoft, Meta all performed great. About 20 seconds, Brad. Any thoughts on that?
Well, it's a good question. It's probably the lack of kind of top line user growth. I mean, Meta at Facebook and Instagram added users. Snap has struggled with that. And you know, perhaps a little less global exposure than some of their competitors.
Yeah, Snap had 383 million users daily in the first quarter, in line with analyst estimates. Brad Stone, you're a gem. I know you're busy. I know your team is. We love it when you can join us. Brad Stone, there in San Francisco, our San Francisco bureau, joining us via Zoom. Jeff Bezos and the Invention of a Global Empire and the Everything Store. He knows so much about this company. Those are two books he's written. Check it out. Amazon's up 9%.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern. Listen on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, and the Bloomberg Business app. Or watch us live on YouTube.
He did also mention Snap, which is getting hammered. It's off its lows in the aftermarket, but still down about 19%. Let's get to it, because some disappointment, certainly, as you can see by the share trade here. Let's get to it with Bloomberg News technology reporter Alex Borinka. She's on Zoom in our LA bureau, covers this space. Alex, a lot of disappointment. Why don't you walk us through the quarter and why investors are so disappointed here?
Definitely a lot of disappointment, and I think that disappointment really is kind of floating around this top line. Revenue declined for the first time ever for this company that's always been seen kind of as a growth company. And, you know, there's a little bit of surprise here, too, because even though the company had guided for a revenue decrease, they guided for a decrease in the first quarter. The forecast they're giving for the second quarter is another consecutive quarter of sales declines. Some of this is self-inflicted too. Snap told us 3 months ago that they're making a lot of changes to their advertising tools, and that would impact revenue for the quarter. They didn't say that it was going to kind of drag on for a while, which seems like it is what's happening here. And when you kind of dig into layers deeper on the results I'm seeing here, another really important number for investors is users. Mm-hmm. User growth came in right at analyst estimates, so there's no kind of upside to offset that downside that you're seeing on the top line.
Talk to us about the ad space, and specifically Snap kind of tweaking the design of its direct response ads. You mentioned the impact of that. To what extent are these earnings and the market reaction about the ad space in particular for Snap?
For Snap, it's all about that ad space. They are a smaller player in the ad world. They have much less share than, say, Alphabet or Meta, but the vast majority of their dollars come from advertising revenue. And historically, Snap has been stronger in something called brand advertising, which is kind of telling the big picture story of your brand, and less on what you mentioned, which is direct response ads, those ads where you see something, you click on it, and you buy it right there. In the current economic environment, marketers are really preferring those direct response ads because they can directly tie return on investment. They can prove out saying somebody clicked on this dress video and bought this dress versus, you know, someone likes a brand better because of a brand advertisement. So to have Snap kind of playing around with those direct response ads, a lot of marketers have backed away, and it's clear that they're not spending on the platform. Now, the company will say they had to make these changes. This will improve their business in the long run, but it does seem like there is quite a bit, at least 20% downward pressure on the stock of impatience from investors in terms of the story that they're telling today.
All right. So as you note in your story, and I'm looking at, this was a stock that back in September of 2021 was above $83 a share. We're now just under $11. Okay. So a very different world, certainly in terms of market value. You write in your story, though, Alex, you talk about how they have also been looking for new streams of revenue. And there's things about, you know, trying on clothes virtually and other things. Is this something that could ultimately move that revenue needle and be a big driver of growth going forward?
It potentially could. I actually chatted to Snap's CEO about a week ago, talking at his product conference, saying, hey, Snap looks like a very different company now. They're doing things like selling subscriptions. They're doing things like selling software to businesses. It's a really interesting moment for them. So there's potential there, but these things are so early days that they're not offsetting the losses they're seeing from the ad business.
I want to talk about the Meta piece because they had a big win yesterday, and they also had a big win when it came to their ads and their ad revenue, which was critical to watch, as it was with Snap today. Does the win for Meta yesterday make the results today from Snap even worse for investors?
Sort of. So Meta's story is a little bit different because of how big they are. They have certainly been challenged by the general dismalness of the ad business, by marketers pulling back spending. But their business is so much bigger, and Snap is so much more of a kind of real true growth company, that's all Snap kind of has the ability to rely on. Snap has also, you know, cut costs. They've done a lot of the things we've seen from the bigger players. But because folks really kind of bet on them for that kind of all-in growth, 100% quarter over quarter in past years, to see that number fall makes it a little bit challenging. With Meta, you know, the big question for them has been, okay, you have this big core ad business. Are you spending enough time there to make sure it's still going well in this challenged ad environment? And also, what else are you spending on? This whole metaverse thing is not something that we will realize in the next decade or so. And are those dollars actually going to things that are going to increase the value of the business? So kind of similar kind of wins affecting both of those companies. But I think they're just kind of size and status in the ad market makes it a little bit of a different tale.
You know, Alex, I always think about, you know, more broadly what's going on in social media and just all the things, whether it's apps, whether it's streaming services, everything competing for our attention. At some point, there's got to be a little bit of a bust. And I think of this, I caught up with Alexis Ohanian this week, right? The co-founder of Reddit, you know, and he too said, you know, social media, you know, culturally maybe going to go through a rethink, if you will. How do you look at it? And so, is it a case of some of the smaller guys are going to fall to the wayside? Or, I don't know, how do you think of it big picture? And then how do investors need to think about it maybe for some shifts that might be to come?
It's a really interesting moment, and I'll actually use Meta's earnings to kind of illustrate this. For, you know, as long as we've had social, it's really been about who follows you and kind of developing that following and choosing the people you follow. When TikTok kind of smashed on the scene, they changed the game. They made it about what content is best and what content's going to resonate with the user's interests instead of with the people that that user will follow. Meta, YouTube, they've all copied kind of that TikTok idea where now your feed is full of things they think you might be interested in that's selected for you by an algorithm. Less so your friends and family. And so Meta and Alphabet have been trying to kind of figure out how to match ads with those interest groups on this new kind of world, whereas Snap has taken a little bit of a different approach. They have always had kind of the core feature of Snapchat being person-to-person communication, that kind of closed loop. But I will say it's really interesting in the last few weeks here, Snap has announced that more people can now post content publicly. So you're seeing some kind of changes. And I think there's this really interesting tension right now between folks wanting to stay connected with friends and family and a lot of the platforms starting to move away from that in favor of showing you things that are maybe more entertaining, maybe more in the taking screen time from the Netflixes and Hulus of the world. But it's less about, you know, your aunt in Texas or your friend who's living in New York City.
Yeah, hey, that's really funny.
Yeah, no, it's so true.
I've been spending a little bit, like for the first time, I'm finally like checking out TikTok. I know I'm a little bit slow to the game, but kind of playing around with that more than like sitting down for hours, you know, binging on a series.
Yeah, no, I do it sometimes when I don't have the energy to pick a show. Alex, I want to end on your story about big tech being obsessed with cost cutting, except for when it comes to AI. Tell me what's going on there.
Yeah, I kind of made the argument in our newsletter today that AI is coming for your jobs, just not the way you thought. Meta, Alphabet, Microsoft, they've all come out kind of promising these big cost cuts while also kind of emphatically reminding investors that they're spending tons of money on AI. So where is that money coming from? You can look back to the 40,000 positions that they've eliminated over the past few months to kind of keep those savings and reinvest those funds into artificial intelligence. So in this kind of big AI arms race that we're in right now, a lot of that's being interestingly funded by big tech from the dollars that are not going to headcount, that are not going to offices, that are only going to kind of the products that are getting folks really excited and leaving a lot of former employees kind of out to dry.
Good to be a programmer right now, really, you know. really quickly, 15 seconds, what would you ask Snap on the earnings call?
I want to know at what point revenue turns around, the changes that they're making, when do those kick in, and when do they start luring advertisers to keep that top line from continuing to slip.
All right. Great stuff as always. Our Alex Barranca, Bloomberg News technology reporter there in LA, and check out her newsletter. You can find it, Bloomberg Tech Daily Newsletter. Just sign up at Bloomberg.com/technology.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. You need a company with extensive experience in specialized insurance. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and helping provide coverage that suits your needs. The Hartford offers insurance solutions that help mid to large-sized businesses, like yours, effectively manage risk, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. With extensive experience in underwriting, risk engineering services, and claims, The Hartford goes beyond the expected to deliver innovative, customizable solutions and service that your industry, that your business, demands. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing, entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus & Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Business app, and YouTube. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
Pressure is building on President Biden to respond after House Republicans unified on a set of demands to avert a catastrophic U.S. debt default in the coming weeks. So there's pressure on the president to really sit down with Speaker Kevin McCarthy. Well, Bloomberg Washington correspondent Anne-Marie Horton did sit down with the Speaker of the House to talk about where we are. Check it out, everybody.
Many people doubted you were going to be able to get this bill passed through the floor. You proved them wrong. You successfully got it through the floor. 217 voting in favor of you. President Biden, though, says he's only going to meet with you if you separate the fiscal spending cuts, the budget, with the debt ceiling. So what comes next?
Well, I don't know, because it was 85 days ago I sat down with the president, February 1st, talking about finding a sensible, responsible way to raise the debt limit and make us less dependent on China, curve inflation, and bring growth to this economy. And that's exactly what we just did. The president then said he wasn't going to meet with me until we showed him a plan. So then I showed him a plan, and then we passed it. You know, the way government works is the House passes the bill, the Senate passes a bill, and then you conference together, and the president can sign, decide whether he signs it or not. The challenge here is the Senate's done nothing. But I shouldn't be rude. They did name March Maine Maple Syrup Month. They did get that done. But they haven't done anything on the debt ceiling, and the president has ignored this problem. He's actually putting the economy of America in jeopardy by not doing anything, because only the House has raised the debt limit, passed a bill to do that, and at the same time, grow the economy. And we did it with ideas that he has voted for, work requirements. He voted for that as a senator. But more importantly, just a couple months ago in Wisconsin, it passed with 82% of the vote to limit our growth in the future so government doesn't get out of control. Well, that's an idea from Joe Manchin. We help the supply chain. We repeal 87,000 IRS agents. We make America energy independent. We cut the red tape so we could build things again in America. I don't think that's radical. And the words that are coming out of the White House that we are going to melt children's bones, we're going to create asthma, there's nothing in the bill that does that. It actually protects veterans, protects our military, makes us curve inflation, but keeps us a stronger pace for the future.
All right, that, of course, was the U.S. Speaker of the House, Kevin McCarthy, catching up with our Bloomberg Washington correspondent, Anne-Marie Horton. If you want to hear more of the interview, just go to Bloomberg.com or check it out on the Bloomberg Terminal. This is Bloomberg Radio.
To admit it's getting better, a little better, all the time.
Well, things can maybe get for the over 100 million obese and overweight individuals in the United States. There is a story in the new issue of Bloomberg Business Week. It's out on newsstands, online at Bloomberg.com/businessweek, and on the Bloomberg terminal. And many of these individuals would love to lose a bunch of weight to improve their health situation. And you know what? There's a bunch of drugs out there that can do that. The big problem, though, is the cost and having to use the drug for the rest of your life. All right, let's get into it with our Bloomberg News healthcare reporting team, who wrote the story of Emma Court and Bob Langreth. They are both here in our Interactive Broker studio. So excited to have both of you with us. Emma, why don't you kick it off with us and tell us about this class of drugs, which they were mentioned at the Oscars. Comedians talk about them. I think Elon Musk has talked about them. Tell us what we're talking about.
Yeah, well, first of all, thank you so much for having us on. We're really excited about the story. It's the cover story this week, so we're thrilled. These new drugs are called effectively GLP-1s. They're named after a hormone they mimic that essentially helps people feel fuller, they have less appetite, they eat less, and they lose weight. What's interesting about these drugs is they're not all that new. This class has been around for diabetes for many years, but more recently, pharma companies have been developing them specifically for obesity. There's a couple of different names for them. People are very familiar by now with Ozempic, which is a diabetes drug. That's the one that Jimmy Kimmel joked about at the Oscars. But there are also drugs called
Mounjaro. I can't remember if everybody laughed or whether it was like deadpan because it was like hitting too close
to home.
Anyway, go ahead.
Well, there are a number of perhaps less well-known drugs, including a new one called Mounjaro that hasn't been formally approved for obesity but likely will in the next year. There's also a drug called Wegovy, which was the first sort of highly effective obesity drug approved in the U.S. And what's really interesting about them is, you know, these are drugs that are helping people lose up to 50 pounds in some cases. So they're way more effective than anything that had been available for weight loss before. And it's getting a lot of doctors and patients excited about it.
So Bob, come in here, because we've all, I think, heard in our lifetimes about a variety of different diet pills and ways to lose weight. Certainly as a woman growing up in the 90s, heard about plenty of them. How is Ozempic, Wegovy, how is it different, and what are the risks and the some of the benefits Emma talked about?
Yeah, one of the really interesting things for me is I've been covering the drug industry for decades, and you know, obesity, weight loss, that was kind of always like a graveyard for drugs. The drug industry had been trying for a long time to come up with drugs. There was the kind of, there were a whole bunch of safety recalls. One of the most famous ones or infamous ones was Fen-Phen back in the late 90s, where one of the components caused heart problems. So obesity drugs for a long time had a bad reputation. And these ones, you know, sort of came a little bit almost out of left field. As Emma said, they were developed for diabetes, and drug companies increasingly started, you know, noticing the weight loss effects they were seeing. And as they started testing the drugs in people that didn't have diabetes, suffered from obesity but didn't have diabetes, they started seeing even larger like amounts of weight loss. So the safety track record in diabetes is pretty good. Like, all drugs are not without risks, you know, but they do have a number of side effects, including nausea and vomiting and diarrhea potentially. So they do have a bunch of GI side effects, and you actually have to titrate them up slowly. These are injectable drugs. It's not a simple pill. You have to inject them, most of them.
Weekly, most of them?
Yeah, the new ones are weekly. And what's happened is, as they've gotten to sort of more potent, long-acting ones, they've seen the anti-obesity effect increase. And that's when they've started to get some of these dramatic weight loss. And the Eli Lilly Mounjaro drug, which is like the newest one, it's only approved for diabetes, but Eli Lilly is very soon going to seek approval for obesity. That's the one that's shown some of the most dramatic weight loss effects so far, and they just had another positive study out today.
Why is it so expensive?
It's a billion-dollar question.
I mean, I feel like we ask this so often about drugs, and I know we do, but why is it, especially it's been around for a while, right? I'm just curious, why is it so expensive?
So some of these drugs are newer, and they are the most expensive ones. So they are new. They can't say they've been around for many years. You know, it's a difficult question, and we certainly asked the companies about it, and we didn't get a super straight answer on it, I would say. I'm curious what Bob thinks about those.
Well, I've been asking drug companies about their pricing
forever,
strategies
right?
forever. You know, that is one question. When you ask, it's very, very difficult to get, like, my sense is they don't really tell you the real answer, like what happened in the back room when they decided to
price. I have a brother who was in pharmaceuticals for over 20 years, and he was always like, listen, we do so much R&D. And I'm like, yeah, but come on, you also make a ton of money on stuff.
So, but basically in the U.S., you know, it's a free market, and drug companies can price their drugs at kind of whatever price they want. And these, when they came on the market as diabetes drugs, they were priced, you know, fairly high. And some of the pricing, there's one, the Wegovy drug, which is a higher dose version of Ozempic that Novo Nordisk sells for obesity. They priced at an even higher price than Ozempic. It's exact, different doses of the exact same, you know, chemical compound, but one is a higher price. The obesity one is a higher price.
I think an interesting aspect of this is, like, when you look at the sheer number of people who would be eligible for these drugs, in the U.S., it's more than 100 million people, right? So it's like...
it's massive.
Why are the prices so high, given that the market opportunity is huge? And we actually talked to one of the sort of foundational scientists in this field. His name is Dan Drucker, and he was one of the, like, guys who helped discover these hormones in the body many, many years ago. And he said, you know, he's asked companies over the years, why don't you just do, you know, be the McDonald's in the space, which is kind of an ironic comparison if you think about it. But, you know, why don't you come out with really cheaper versions of these drugs and lots of people will take them and you'll still make a bunch of money?
Because you're talking about one in three. How many was our population? One in three.
42% of adults in the U.S.
have obesity. Yeah.
So what's interesting, too, and I feel like there's a bigger, broader conversation when it comes to healthcare, right? I mean, being overweight, we saw it in COVID. Like, that could make you more susceptible to not having a great outcome. I mean, being overweight for most people causes all these other problems. We know it's a big reason why there's so much diabetes. Where is the medical community? Where is the insurance community? I'm thinking about if we can get people to be not so overweight, that it's just better for their health outcome, their outcomes, and also their healthcare costs.
Well, one really important and interesting aspect of this is we often blame weight for a lot of things in our society. And it's interesting to look at this idea of BMI and realize it's kind of imprecise, right? It was supposed to be kind of a population level measure, and instead it's been applied to individuals. So, like, if someone has a certain weight, regardless of what their health looks like in other aspects, they are obese just because of their BMI, right? If you think about that, it's kind of an interesting aspect. Like, you could be totally healthy, have no diabetes, have no high cholesterol, whatever, and you're still ill by some of these kind of modern standards. So it is kind of a nuanced, complicated topic. While higher weights have been really highly associated with lots of different diseases, it's important to note that there are a lot of shades of gray here. Another interesting aspect of this is, like, how...
So does that mean not as many people would really kind of be eligible for this drug?
Well, that's the big question, million, right? Yeah. So if you think about it, maybe not everyone who qualifies as overweight or obese is necessarily going to be the best candidate for these drugs. There's a big kind of murky middle of people who, where it's not totally clear how big a danger their weight poses.
I mean, this is a really important question here. So, like, the risks of you know, suffering from obesity, you know, as opposed to someone's normal weight, a lot of that comes from epidemiological studies. Mm-hmm. You know, and what's not been proven over the long term is, if you take the weight off with one of these drugs, you know, do you eliminate all these, like, actual, like, risks, like the risk of heart disease and strokes and other, like, concrete, you know, clinical downsides? They haven't actually proven that in trials right now. It's not necessarily the case that, you know, you'll get all that benefit, because these are epidemiology studies, and you're comparing risk factors, and there might be other things that are different, you know, when they do these complicated comparisons. So that's what the insurers say. Hey, this is not proven. This is only really proven to take off a lot of weight. You haven't proven that it prevents a heart attack or a stroke 5 years from now.
And you have to take it forever, seemingly, to prevent the heart disease?
That's what the pharma companies are saying. That's what the doctors are saying. There have been studies of this new drug, Wegovy, that show when people quit the drug after a year, the weight comes back for most people. So that is a big issue when you talk about costs and such an expensive drug. Like, this is possibly a lifelong thing. And it does raise questions about, well, what is the side effect profile here? We're not talking about taking something for a few months or a year.
It's forever, potentially. Does insurance tend to cover it if you are at that BMI then? What's the spread on
it's,
how
much it's covered? All over the place right now. We did a lot of reporting this. It's all over the place right now. And, you know, whether you have access to one of these drugs may kind of just depend on the luck of the draw and what your particular insurance company you have to you end up at. But like basically three quarters of state, we surveyed all 50 states, state Medicaid programs. Three quarters of the states have very little coverage for obesity drugs. And you're roughly, give or take a few, three quarters of private insurance generally don't cover obesity drugs either. Now, the coverage, we found signs that the coverage is starting to increase. For example, in Medicaid, eight different states told us they're considering it. But this is like the big battle that's going to be going on the next year between the drug companies and the doctors that favor more coverage and insurance companies. That's like the big battle.
It was
happening.
Amazing to see how much coverage ranged in this 50-state survey of Medicaid plans, which Medicaid covers low-income folks for health insurance. I mean, there was one state that literally told us, we will pay for, you know, some obesity drugs for people under the age of 21, for young people, but not adults. We were like, what?
Like, what's the justification of that? I mean, what would make it much more clear? I just got about 30 seconds. Is it some study that needs to be, like, what is it that would be like health insurers would be like, yeah, we got to be in on this or not?
The big studies, the most important studies that are coming is that both Eli Lilly and Novo Nordisk, which are the two makers, they're studying their drugs in people with obesity to show they can prevent heart attacks and strokes. And it, you know, if they do that, if those studies succeed, it's gonna be much, much harder for insurers to deny coverage.
Yeah, and that's gonna be a big, big thing that's gonna come in the next couple of months. Heart disease is the leading killer of Americans, so this is something with really high stakes.
All right, great story, guys. It is the cover of Bloomberg Business Week. As we said, it is out on newsstands. It's already on the Bloomberg Terminal and online at bloomberg.com/businessweek. Emma Court and Bob Langreth, both healthcare reporters here at Bloomberg News, joining us here in our interactive broker story. Be sure to check it out. It's also going to be in our weekend show on Bloomberg Radio. This is Bloomberg Business Week.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. You need a company with extensive experience in specialized insurance. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and helping provide coverage that suits your needs. The Hartford offers insurance solutions that help mid to large-sized businesses, like yours, effectively manage risk, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. With extensive experience in underwriting, risk engineering services, and claims, The Hartford goes beyond the expected to deliver innovative, customizable solutions and service that your industry, that your business, demands. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's STIFEL.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no, 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 no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I want to drive.
It's the question that drives us.
This is The Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
All right, everybody. We have just under 18 minutes left in today's trading session, getting ready to wrap up the Thursday trade. We've got Big earnings coming, as Charlie mentioned, Amazon, Intel, a few others after the close, holding on to gains, though, on the equity side of things. So let's get to it. Our Drive to the Close guest on this Thursday is Shanil Ramji, Senior Investment Manager at Pictet Asset Management, here in our Bloomberg Interactive Broker Studio with Maddie and myself. Nice to have you here. How are you?
Yeah, very good. Thanks for having me. Nice to be in New York.
Yeah. Oh, good. Where are you typically based?
In London.
In London. Yeah. All right. So tell me mood difference between London and here.
Well, firstly, the weather's not as good in London, let me tell you that much. But no, it's lovely to be back in New York. I haven't been back for several years, and the buzz is great.
It does feel like the energy. When you're in London, though, what is the conversation you think most that you guys talk about at work versus like when you come over to the U.S. and you're talking to different clients? Is it a little bit different? Is it the same stuff?
Yeah, in the U.S., it's typically quite U.S.-focused. You know, we have a much more global view in London, and it's always the US versus the rest, right? When are we going to see performance come through from the rest of the world? And we do see that coming to the fore this year in some ways, with European indices doing quite well this year, and the reopening of China really starting to drive some investment decisions. So coming to the US this week, I think this is what people have been asking about.
Are you monitoring every single potential data point that could impact the Fed's moves as much as we are here?
You'd be surprised that in Europe we care a lot about that too, right? So we are watching each and every statement also, but we try and have that more applicable to what's going on elsewhere. What is the ECB? What is the BOE? What is the BOJ? What is the Chinese? So how are they responding to what the Fed is doing? But you know, the Fed is still the big guy in the room, and we really need to know what Jay Powell and co are going to do.
Well, so having said that, you do take a global perspective, and lucky for us, you've shared some notes with our producer, so we know that you do like non-U.S. equities more than you like U.S. equities, from what I understand. Make that case.
So at the moment, we know that the valuations in the U.S. are quite high. If we think S&P 500 is about 18 times. When we look elsewhere around the world, we think looking at much lower valuations, 12 times in Europe, 10 times in the U.K., much lower in parts of Asia. So we can say on a valuation case that this is interesting, but we know that rest of the world's always been cheaper in general. So
correct.
Why now? Why do we think now? So firstly, we think there's a desynchronization in the global economy. We see the U.S. economy is slowing. We saw today's GDP number a bit slower, a bit more inflation. And when we look at the rest of the world, having had the big energy scare that we saw at the end of the last year in Europe and thinking that we were going to have a big recession in Europe first quarter this year, that didn't materialize. And we're getting a cyclical upswing in Europe, but that's also aided by the fact that China reopened. Right. So the China reopening has helped look at non-US growth being a little bit better than US growth. And that's turning into some positives for earnings, not just in China, but elsewhere.
There's Europe, and you know, Europe's a pretty big area, region. What specifically? Are there certain markets? Are there certain types of industries, certain companies?
Absolutely. So in Europe, we really like the consumer sectors, the consumer cyclicals. But really, in a world where we know that there's this inflation pressure, we think the high-end consumer is doing the best, right? The affluent consumer has the ability to spend more. So when we look at those premium brands, when we look at those luxury companies, they continue to grow their revenue base. They are interesting companies in the sense that...
So like your LVMHs.
Absolutely. LVMH is the LVMH, for example, encompasses all those luxury brands, and we think there are many of them in Europe, and that's what Europe does best. You know, we know that those are some of the best companies in Europe are those luxury companies.
Sorry, U.S. luxury brands. We love you, even if Shanil doesn't. I'm just kidding.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's...
No, but I know what you're saying, and we've talked about that. We've done a lot of reporting that as these results come in, the luxury names have really been outperforming, and we are talking about the China reopening as one of the reasons. But U.S. shoppers are buying, too, certainly U.S. high-end shoppers.
Yeah, why do you think that U.S. high-end shoppers are more susceptible to headwinds than European high-end shoppers?
I think the U.S. high-end consumer is also going to be quite resilient. We've seen the numbers today on the consumption being still quite strong, right? So we know that the consumer in the U.S. has been good. And
those are January numbers, as our Mike McKee reminded us. And we'll get March, I think, tomorrow. So yeah. It was kind of before the banking, exactly. You know, kind of meltdown of a few names. So it'll be interesting to see if it continues to hold up.
But even if we look at travel, for example, travel and leisure, when we look at the hotel chain numbers, when we look at the airline numbers, these numbers have been pretty good. So we know that the consumers are spending on what they hold dear. And right now, what they hold dear is some of those luxury brands and also the travel and leisure that they care about most.
Shanil, how much would you suggest for an investor to have of their portfolio with non-US exposure at this point?
At the moment, just in that luxury consumer discretionary area, the portfolio that we build for clients has about 5% in those areas. And we think that that's just because the consumer is the driver right now in the global economy. We do think, however, that that will slow over time. And what we see in that desynchronization that I mentioned is also desynchronization in the sectors of the economy that are working. And one of those sectors that we think could have some better performance in the second half of the year is the more manufacturing or industrial sector. And we are seeing some of those numbers come out.
For over in Europe or more broadly?
More broadly, globally. And I think the European story in terms of the industrials, we see earning revisions pick up. And that's partly due to some of the fiscal stimulus that we see around some of the environmental spend that's going on. Look at either the IRA or what this similar policies in Europe. These are spending that governments are doing that are going to benefit some of these industrial companies. And their order books are already showing that.
But a lot of consumer discretionary companies in the U.S. are having amazing earnings. I'm thinking about McDonald's, Pepsi. So maybe not just the high-end shoppers.
And they're global names.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So got about 30 seconds left.
when we look at those global U.S. companies, they have been having good numbers. And for example, I think Coca-Cola said some of their coffee shops in China were really showing positive earnings. So you know it's open when people are going out to coffee shops. So you know these are some of the data that we look at. So it's not just European companies.
Right.
You are right. It is also American companies, but we think the consumer generally is the place to be.
All right, that we're certainly see that, and as you said, higher end in particular. Shanil, thank you so much. Really appreciate it. Shanil Ramji, he's Senior Investment Manager at Pictet Asset Management, joining us here in our Bloomberg Interactive Brokers studio.
This is the Bloomberg Business Week podcast, available on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. Listen live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, TuneIn, and the Bloomberg Business app. You can also watch us live every weekday on YouTube and always on the Bloomberg Terminal.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Collaborate for a greener future at the Bloomberg Green Festival, a groundbreaking celebration of the thinkers, doers, and innovators leading the way, from design and culture to technology, science, and entertainment. Hear from inspirational speakers and immerse yourself in climate solutions, July 10th through 13th in Seattle. Title sponsor, Amazon. Official airline, Alaska Airlines. Get 20% off using promo code RADIO20 at BloombergLive.com/greenfestival.